Welcome to Radio Sefarad's English Corner. I'm your host, Linda Jimenez, bringing news and other features of Jewish interest to Radio Sefarad's English-speaking audience in Spain and around the world. Our trivia question for this week is, what opposing views did different Jewish groups have with regard to permitting a fascist march through the East End of London in 1936? On Sunday, October 4th, 1936, Sir Oswald Mosley, the leader of the British Union of Fascists, attempted to march down Cable Street, right through the heart of the Jewish East End in London. What he and his thousands of members didn't expect was the strength and solidarity of ordinary Londoners indignant at the blatant provocation. An estimated 200,000 to 300,000 residents formed roadblocks and cut off the fascists' route, with the battle itself then taking place between the East Enders and the police, who were determined to allow the fascists to pass. Derek Gadd is the head of governance at London Councils and an active member of the Cable Street Group, whose aim is to keep alive the spirit of and pay tribute to the courage of those who came together that day to stop the fascist blackshirts from marching through this predominantly Jewish neighborhood. Among other activities, they've interviewed many veterans and published a book about the history leading up to the battle. Mr. Gadd spoke with us about what happened that day, the history behind it, and the Cable Street Group and how they commemorate this event.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us today. First of all, congratulations on being voted the best city in the world for quality of life.
You're very kind. London is a great city, and we all love living here.
You are the head of governance for London Councils. Could you tell us what London Councils is? Is it an official institution?
Yes, I can. Although this is very separate to the activity I do for Cable Street. That's a sort of private matter, the Cable Street thing. London Councils, the way London is run, there is a mayor of London, as I'm sure you're aware, and they run some services across the city. But in the main, most of the services provided for residents are provided by the councils. There are 33 local authorities in London. And my organisation, London Councils, is a sort of umbrella body that brings them all together, to try to get common perspectives on particular issues around delivery of local government services.
Oh, okay. But this has absolutely nothing to do with Cable Street.
Nothing to do. My Cable Street activity is entirely, that's my own, it's my hobby, if you like.
Okay. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of Cable Street?
Sure. Well, first of all, the Battle of Cable Street is a title or a term that's been applied to an event that took place on October the 4th, 1936, when the leader of the British Union of Fascists, a man called Sir Oswald Mosley, threatened to hold a march of his fascist black shirts through the East End, in particular through a predominantly Jewish area of the East End.
Before we go any further, can you describe the neighborhood to us? Because I'm sure most of our listeners are not familiar with...
Yeah, sure, for sure. Okay, London, great city, and again voted the great best city to live in again. It's a big city, and it's an amalgam, really. There is the heart of the city, which is the perhaps the area where maybe any of your listeners who come and traveled as tourists will know reasonably well, the centre of government at Westminster, and also the entertainments district. Around that, there is then the suburbs, if you like, the area where people in the main live. And to the west of London, or to the west of the centre, there is the affluent area, Mayfair, these kind of areas where the very well-to-do live. But to the East End is the traditional working-class area and a poor area. And in particular, along by the River Thames, there were the docks. Well, they still are there, but they don't operate as docks anymore. These were built from the beginning of the 19th century right up until into the 1920s. So that's the East End of London, places like Stepney, Whitechapel, Wapping, Poplar. These are the areas which were basically poor, working class, and traditionally had been the home of migrants. And that goes back as far as the 17th century, when French Huguenots, the French Protestants who fled violence against them, they came and lived in an area, Spitalfields, where they were weavers. They brought silk weaving with them. And they were the first in a whole series of migrations that came to settle in the East End, where obviously property was cheap because it was the working class area and it was the sort of places where migrants could afford to live. And also because it was the area of the docks, so it's where many of them would literally arrive off the boat. And these waves of migration are perhaps best summed up. There is a single building in Brick Lane, which is a thoroughfare in Spitalfields, famous nowadays for Indian restaurants. Again, if any of your listeners ever travel to London and want to do something a little bit more unusual, they might decide to go for a curry in Brick Lane. But this area was first the home in the 17th century to Huguenot weavers, and there was a chapel constructed there. As time progressed, the area then became a focus for particularly Jewish migrants from into the 19th century. These were Russo-Polish Jews fleeing pogroms in Eastern Europe. And this particular building that was a Huguenot chapel then became a synagogue. And the Jewish population moved into the area from the late 19th century into the early 20th century. And like most migrant populations, they started out, you know, with very limited means, but they worked hard, they prospered, and very soon they moved out of the East End and moved into more affluent areas in North London and gave way to the next wave of migrants, which came in the 1970s, which were migrants from the Indian subcontinent, from the British Commonwealth, and in particular, the country that became Bangladesh in 1971. So this building that I'm talking about is now a mosque. So a building that started life as a Protestant chapel then became a synagogue and is now a mosque. And I think that sort of sums up really the East End in the sense of the home that it's become to waves of migrants. It's now a very large Bangladeshi area. There's a very large 30% of the population in Tower Hamlets. The borough is of Bangladeshi origin. But again, like the Jews before them, I'm sure as they become better off and more well-to-do, and they're beginning to move out to the areas further out and more affluent areas. And if you like, it's probably going to be the next wave of migrants coming in.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about the history of Cable Street and the battle.
Sure. Now, I think probably the best thing to do is to provide a bit of context, because I'm sure your listeners will not be all entirely familiar with the history of the political context in which this event took place. So 1930s, fascism is on the rise in Europe. Mussolini has taken over in Italy in the 1920s. Hitler becomes Chancellor of Germany in 1933. And a British politician, an MP, a charismatic individual called Sir Oswald Mosley, had ambitions to achieve high office. And he started out, he was actually, first of all, he was in the Conservative Party, he then switched to the Labour Party, and eventually he decided that these parties were not best suited either to his ambitions or to the needs of the nation. And as he saw on the continent the rise of fascism, he set up the British Union of Fascists. Now, this was set up in 1932 and attracted a significant membership, peaking at about 50,000. And he'd hoped to win seats in Parliament. Eventually, he hoped to become, literally emulate Mussolini and Hitler and become the Prime Minister of the country, leading a fascist party. I mean, it happened in Italy, it happened in Germany. But there was significant resistance to Mosley, and the ideas that he put forward didn't rest easily in Britain. And there was a turning point came in the development of the British Union of Fascists, a place called Olympia. Olympia is a big concert and exhibition venue in West London. And the BUF held a rally there, a big meeting in 1934. And before that time, Mosley had attracted support from very significant figures. For example, Lord Rothermere, who was the owner of a newspaper chain, including a very big popular national newspaper and the Daily Mail. And this newspaper carried a headline, "Hurrah for the Blackshirts." This was denoting its support. Anyway, this big rally took place in 1934, and a number of those opposed to Mosley managed to get into this rally. And as soon as the rally started, they began to shout and heckle and taunt the speakers. Mosley had been prepared for this, and he had a group of basically uniformed thugs, not to what too fine a point, ready, acting as stewards, ready to deal with this. And the violence that took place in this rally was the thing that really hit the headlines, with these people being, men and women amongst them, being badly beaten up by these fascist thugs before being ejected. And this was greeted with utter horror by the British populace. And the membership of the BUF plummeted from 50,000 down to 5,000 in a couple of years. Mosley, realizing that he had to do something here to revive the fortunes of his party, hit upon the idea of, and I should obviously say, in the mid-30s, Hitler in Germany was beginning to espouse anti-Semitism as his part of his fascist creed. And this was adopted also by Mosley. And he decided that the East End of London, with a working-class, white working-class population, would be amenable to his anti-Semitism, because there was also a large Jewish population there, and there may well be hostilities and animosities. And in fact, he had set up four branches of his BUF in the East End. So he decided to hold a march through the East End and addressing the march at each of the four headquarters of the East End BUF to mark the fourth anniversary of the founding of the BUF. So this was announced in the autumn of 1936. Again, some context for your listeners. You'll be, of course, aware that the other European nation to become convulsed by the conflict between fascism and anti-fascism, often in the form of communism, was Spain. And that, as you know, in July 1936, Francisco Franco, General Franco, helped by the German Luftwaffe, transported the Spanish Army of Africa to the Spanish mainland, and a revolt took place against the Republican government, and the Spanish Civil War started. Now, this was something that anti-fascists in England greeted with great concern and horror, in fact. And already, in fact, by the autumn of 1936, volunteers had begun to try to get out to Spain from Britain and the rest of Europe and from the United States to try to fight alongside the Republicans against Franco in what became the International Brigades. And of course, the desperate defenders of Madrid, the Spanish capital, had mounted a defense of the capital behind the slogan of No Pasarán. Now, back to Cable Street, back to the UK, back to England. So Mosley decides he's going to march through the East End. Now, this was seen as a very deliberate provocation by many on the left, many anti-fascists in Britain, and also by many Jews in the East End and elsewhere. The issue, or the problem, if you like, was what to do about it. First of all, an attempt was made to use proper, if you like, legitimate parliamentary means, and a huge petition was got up, signed by 100,000 people, and was delivered to the Home Secretary, calling on the march to be banned. But the Home Secretary said, no, the Home Secretary said, you know, there is a tradition of freedom of speech in England. I see no reason to ban the march. So with the, if you like, attempts by legitimate means thwarted, anti-fascists began to think what else they could do. And at this point, there was a fairly major, shall we say, argument developed in certainly amongst Jews in Britain and amongst anti-fascists. And what I suppose you could call the establishment, the Jewish establishment, represented by an organization called the Jewish Board of Deputies and by the newspaper, the Jewish Chronicle. Their approach was to say, ignore him. Let him have his march. We don't care. The more you draw attention to it, the more you're creating publicity for him. On the other hand, Jews in the East End said absolutely not why. They were not going to allow Mosley to march on their streets in this provocation. The Communist Party and the other political parties, the The other political, the mainstream left parties, the Labour Party, the Liberal Party, they tended to follow the lead of the Jewish Board of Deputies, and they tended to urge a freezing out of the march, a policy of ignoring it. But the Communist Party had the day it was planned was the 4th of October, Sunday the 4th of October 1936. The Communist Party, or the Young Communist League, had a rally planned for Trafalgar Square in support of the Republicans in Spain. And at first the Communist Party said, we've got this rally, it's been well and truly, you know, it's been publicised, we're not going to divert attention from our rally, we want our rally to be a success, so no, we're going to ignore the activities of Mosley. Literally days before the 4th of October, the groundswell of opinion, the huge pressure that the Communist Party and others were coming under from their members in the East End, finally had effect, and the Communist Party eventually cancelled its rally in Trafalgar Square and said instead that there was going to be an attempt to stop the march and that communists should all come to the East End to a place called Gardner's Corner, which was it's the gateway to the East End. It's a point at Aldgate where a number of roads radiate into the East End. And anybody marching into the East End was going to have to come through Gardner's Corner. So on the day, the particularly led by the Communist Party, a huge number of people assembled to try and stop Mosley's march. So Mosley and his black shirts, they assembled at Tower Hill as an assembly point in close to the East End. Huge numbers of anti-fascists, as I say, assembled at Gardner's Corner. And the police, 7,000 police, a huge number of police, the entire police mounted division, police aircraft included, started to try and clear the way. Now, Gardner's Corner was thronged with people, and a tram tried to get through the people, get through the crowds. The crowd stopped the tram, told the tram driver what was happening. The tram driver, a trade unionist, removed the key from the tram, got out of the tram, and joined the demonstrators, leaving his tram, effectively blocking the road. So at that point, Gardner's Corner became impassable. There was one other route into the East End, and that was down Cable Street. And instead, the police decided to switch the march to Cable Street. The anti-fascists had come prepared. They'd got a lorry from a builder's yard, which was ready to be turned over to form a barricade. The lorry was turned over, a barricade was built. And what was actually the Battle of Cable Street was a series of running battles between the police and anti-fascists. Mosley's black shirts were still quite a long way away, waiting in their assembly point, ready to march. And the charge, counter-charge by police and anti-fascists around these barricades. And eventually, the Metropolitan Police Commissioner, Sir Philip Game, decided that he could not guarantee Mosley's safety in the East End, called Mosley in, told him that he had to call his march off. Mosley said to him, is that an order? Game said, yes, it is. And Mosley assembled his black shirts, turned them around, and marched through the deserted streets of the city, the financial district. The Battle of Cable Street had been won. And it then goes down in East End history and in anti-fascist history as a great victory for anti-fascism against Mosley and his black shirts.
Is this an incident in British history that kids learn about? Do people know about this, or only if you know about it, you know about it?
I think it's very interesting that it was one of these things that over the years has become less and less, you know, as further and further you get away from 1936, fewer and fewer people know about. So that's what my group, the Cable Street Group, are keen to do, is to try to make sure that it's kept in people's memory. So, you know, I'm always constantly surprised when I talk to people. I'm a historian by background, and even ask people if they've heard of the Battle of Agincourt, things like this, that are the sort of, you know, the stuff of history, and they haven't. And I think quite a few people probably haven't heard of the Battle of Cable Street outside of certainly the Jewish community and perhaps committed left-wing activists.
Is this the first time that you're commemorating it?
No. We've been going since for 30 years. The first time we celebrated it was in 1986, for the 50th anniversary. We organised a march, a rally, and a pop festival. And we've carried on celebrating ever since. There was a big event this year, you may be aware. There was a march. My group didn't organise a march, but we organised some cultural events around it. We had a klezmer band. We had some wonderful, wonderful events. We had some interviews with some of the veterans of the battle, people who were actually at the battle. There was a chap called Max Levitas who gave a one-hour-long interview. He was full of vigour and life and passion about what he'd been a Communist Party councillor in his Stepney in his youth. And he kept people enthralled for an hour, peals of laughter, giving his reminiscences. He's 101 years old.
Wow. So did a lot of people come from all over London or other parts of England to participate in these activities?
There was several thousand at the rally, at the march and the rally, with banners from a number of organisations. So, I mean, I wouldn't say, I don't think they came from across the country, probably just from London, certainly from the East End. So it's probably it is probably quite a localised piece of history, but still one that burns bright in people's memories in the East End of London.
Something that I found when I was doing research for this interview is that there is still a website called oswaldmosley.com, which debunks what they call the myth of Cable Street. And I was wondering if there's still, or again, considering what's going on in Europe, an important far-right wing or fascist presence in the UK, especially with what's going on in other parts of Europe, like in France and Germany.
Not sure. I mean, I think probably, I'd even probably go as far as saying this is probably one of the most important parts of our discussion today. So very quickly, so Battle of Cable Street seemed by a great victory, but there is a particular approach to Cable Street, which is very much different. There are historians, particularly a man called Professor Geoffrey Alderman, who has written extensively, saying that, in fact, Cable Street was the opposite of what anti-fascists claim it to be. First of all, he says it was an affront to the British tradition of free speech. This was an attempt to literally gag Mosley and his fascists. That it backfired because there was actually an increase in membership of the BUF after the Battle of Cable Street. And there was an element similar to the element that I've described, the reaction against the violence of the BUF in Olympia in 1934, there was also a reaction against the violence seen by members of the populace that was communist and anti-fascist violence against the police at Cable Street. So there are two counter views here. There are completely two counter views. Mosley himself, he was interned in the Second World War, but he wasn't completely down and out. He came back in the 1960s. He formed a thing called the Union Movement, and he stood for election to Parliament in the 1966 general election. He didn't get very far. Now, one of the reasons, in fact, it's not been argued why Cable Street does take on a significance nowadays is because of the rise of far-right parties in the UK in the wake of that Union Movement in the 60s. First of all, was the National Front in the 1970s. That was followed by the British National Party. The British National Party achieved some electoral success, getting a number of councillors elected. The first councillor they got elected was in 1993 in Tower Hamlets, in the same borough that the Cable Street exists. They've had a bit of a high point. They've collapsed back now. They've lost all their councillors. But there are others. There are the English Defence League, the Britain First. There seems to be within the English populace, the British populace, the potential for far-right activists, and they emerge in various forms in different groups, as I say, NF, BNP, EDL, these people. They have an efflorescence. They then almost invariably fall out amongst themselves. There's often illegality. There's often arrests, this kind of thing. But they are there. And this is another reason why my group is very keen to keep alive the memory of Cable Street, that, you know, many of us think we need to constantly remind ourselves of the iniquities and the things that happened in the 30s, right the way through up to. And, of course, in the 30s, the Jews were the victims of violent attacks in the East End, and those self-same violent attacks take place now where the victims are Bangladeshis. And, in fact, the march that took place recently was in a small park in Aldgate that was originally called St. Mary's Gardens, is now called Altab Ali Park. And it's called Al-Tab Ali after a Bangladeshi clothing worker called Al-Tab Ali, who was murdered on the day of the council elections in 1978 in a racist attack. So, yes, the violence of the far right is still there. Happily, in Britain, the electoral success that the Front National has achieved in France, and I'm afraid to say a number of other parties across Europe have achieved in recent years, has never been replicated in the UK. But some of us will say one of the reasons why it's not been replicated is because people like myself and people like my group are absolutely clear we must constantly drum home the fact to young people today that the fascist threat is a constant threat. It is a violent, pernicious and unpleasant political ideology that takes particularly migrant groups as victims, and obviously with the migration crisis that exists across Europe at the moment, that's a particularly fertile ground. But these are a constant threat.
Derek, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there because we're out of time, but thank you very much.
Well, that's it for this week. As always, we'd love to hear from you. So please email us any comments or suggestions or questions you'd like us to answer on the air. Our address is English Corner at RadioSefarad.com. See you next week.